Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today. We have an interesting program for you today. I'm really looking forward to it. I know we always find animal behavior very interesting and fascinating. Programs that we do on that topic are always popular. Today, we're going to try and turn that around a little bit and look at how humans think about and respond to animals instead of the other way around. Why are some animals okay to eat and others are pampered pets? What about medical experiments that will advance human health but maybe cost, I don't know, a few million mice a year? Larry Mueller here again. Have a couple of guests with us today who can really help us sort through this. Conflicting ideas, really. Patricia McConnell. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Larry. Good to see you.
Great to see you. Patricia is, of course, certified applied animal behaviorist, dog trainer, author of, I don't know how many.
A few books. Just a few.
Quite a few books. Been a guest on this show many a times. I'm always happy to have her with us. Al Herzog, our other guest, professor, and I talked to you, about a couple of years ago.
Probably. Right, we did.
Yeah. And it was he is a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. He's an anthrozoologist and author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat: Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. And it was really great to have him with us today. And we're fortunate he's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. And it's a free forum that you're going to be able to participate in. We'll certainly talk some more about that as the program goes along. But it's great, Hal, to have you right here in the studio. Appreciate having you by.
Well, it's great to be here. This is the first time I've been in Madison. It's a lovely place.
Well, you are an anthrozoologist, and I'm sure there are a lot of people who say, what the heck is that? What does that mean anyway?
It's a good name, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it.
It's the study of human-animal interactions. And it's very interdisciplinary. The people that do it, some of them are historians. Some of them are in social work. Some of them are in psychology, biology, veterinary medicine. But took this broad perspective on all the different ways that humans relate to and think about and live with other creatures on the earth. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, your book, I love the title. It's Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. Why is it so hard to think straight about animals? Why is it so hard to think that way?
There's two answers. The simple answer is it's hard for us to think about darn near everything. And so what we do is we see these inconsistencies in our behavior, I think, in an almost abstract form when we think about animals, because we are a little bit distant from them. And the other thing is that we don't quite know what to make of what's going on inside their heads. And so that adds a degree of moral complexity. So I think we see the same sorts of difficult moral issues with animals that we see in our lives with people. And we learn a lot about ourselves when we look at how we think about other species, especially in a moral sense.
There's so many aspects of our interactions with animals that necessarily make a whole lot of sense, as you well know. Pet ownership certainly is full of them, and maybe you could mention some of the more interesting contradictions that you see. And I'm asking probably Patricia that same question, but Al, what about it?
Well, I can just give the example in my own life. I have made my peace with eating animals. I eat them, and I don't feel guilty about it. I do feel guilty about being a cat owner.
Well,
my cat owner is a serial killer. She is, and a very efficient one. I saw her take down a hummingbird one time. I didn't know whether to be mad at her or proud of her. But she, living with a cat, cats are obligate carnivores. They eat meat. So you might be a vegan, but if you're a cat lover, your cat doesn't share your dietary interests. And then that falls on you. That you're the one that made the decision to bring that cat into your life.
Yeah.
This is true whether it's an indoor cat or an outdoor cat. They still like to eat meat. And with outdoor cats, it's especially problematic. You have your choice between keeping your cat in the big cage that you happen to call your house, or letting it go out and hang out with its pals that likes to play with and eat outside.
Yeah. We have two cats at home, but they stay inside, but and seem happy. Patricia, you see these contradictions all the time too, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, and there, you know, there's so many of them. I think as a behaviorist, the ones that I saw most often were people who would come into my office and say, I love my dog so much. I can't tell you how much I love my dog. I could never give him up. I could never send him to another place. That wouldn't be responsible. It would break my heart. But yet they had a serious behavioral problem. And when we would start talking about a treatment plan, they'd be like, oh, I can't do that. I can't meet with you actually tonight because I have to take my son to soccer and we're really busy. And I say that with a great sense of generosity and sympathy, because I think so many of us are torn by, on the one hand, wanting to increase our connection with the natural world, which companion animals can do.
Yep.
And wanting to have this enriched, enhanced relationship that so many of us have found that we can have with a member of another species. But yet the world is pulling us away often in so many other ways. You know, people have, you know, there's a whole field now about nature deficit disorder and how little time people are spending outdoors anymore. I mean, I heard Michael Pollan here on Wisconsin Public Radio mm-hmm. just a minute ago talking about his new book, Cooked, and he talked about the fact that people are spending 2 hours a day basically on the internet. And if you're spending 2 hours a day and they're watching television shows about cooking but not cooking. So people are often reading about animals, watching television shows about animals, but they're too busy doing that to walk their dog.
Is that why we have fewer? I guess the figures are that we have fewer dogs and cats in the U.S. now than we have had in previous years. Is that why? Or am I mistaken on that?
What happened is that in the last 2 years, there's actually been a decline in pet keeping in the United States.
Yeah.
It's unclear if that's going to be a trend or not. I think it may well be. And most people think that pet keeping has increased in the United States in the last 30 years. But actually, that's not true. It's been relatively steady. About 60-65% of American homes have a pet. But I think there's a couple of reasons that pet keeping may actually be going down. And they're not related to the fact that people don't like pets as a group anymore. It's related to changing demography of America. Number one is our country is getting older. And what we know is that people, when they retire and as they get older, they're actually – that's the group that's least likely to have pets in terms of age demographics. The ones that have pets are the most attached to them. But when the kids leave and you're traveling or the money's getting low, you tend not to have pets. The other thing is that – the largest percentage of Americans that are pet owners are white. And there's ethnic and racial differences in pet keeping. Hispanics, African Americans are less likely to have pets than whites are. And so what's happening as our country has gotten more racially diverse, pet ownership has gone down. And this is something that the pet products industry is quite concerned about.
Hmm. Well, why keep pets at all, for that matter? Good question, huh?
Oh boy, how long do we have on that one? You know, one of the things that I think Hal and I both spend a lot of time with is the fact that it's a mixed bag. Is not only is it culturally very diverse in terms of how much connection people want with members of another species, but for people who do, there are so many benefits, and you know, we've talked a lot about them. I mean, just the increase in oxytocin when you're stroking a pet clearly had the research is pretty clear in some contexts can increase your immune response, can decrease blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. There's no question that pets can be very, very good for you in some contexts. And that gets a lot of media attention. But you know, as an applied animal behaviorist who saw aggression cases primarily and who saw the dark side, in a way, of, you know, people whose dogs were biting, or dogs who were living in some kind of extremely difficult circumstance, there is a dark side. You know, people trip over their dogs at sort of ridiculous numbers mm-hmm. and injure themselves. People do get bitten by dogs. So it's a very interesting question, I think. Biologically, I think it's a kind of a biological miracle that we can have such an incredibly strong attachment, as some of us do, to a non-human to a member of a non-human species. I mean, it's really amazing. People risk their lives to save their dogs sometimes, mm-hmm. and vice versa. I mean, there are, you know, real credible cases of dogs risking their lives to save their people. I have one of them myself. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty amazing thing, but it doesn't mean there aren't costs. And as Harold and I can tell you, the media doesn't like to talk about the costs quite as much as they do like to talk about the good side.
Yeah, absolutely. We are talking with Patricia McConnell and Hal Herzog today. Hal, his book is Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. Why is it so hard to think straight about animals? He's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Forum on animal research ethics. And I haven't given the number or asked you to join in as you're listening in here, so let me do that right now. Do you think that you're consistent in how you think about animals? Do you think there are inconsistencies in your relationship to a pet versus a wild animal, considered a pest maybe? How do you reconcile that, or do you even need to? Do you need to do that? After you get to, I know there are some other things we want to talk about relating to animal experimentation, whether or not that's acceptable. Give us a call with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler. Gabby Petriana, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking today about the complex relationship between humans and animals with Patricia McConnell and Hal Herzog. Great to have you listening in. Join in with your own questions or comments. Weigh in at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show and post a question or a comment there. Facebook question from Roger, who says groundhogs, they're herbivores. People don't eat them, though, for the most part. Squirrels, rabbits, deer, they're herbivores. People eat them all the time. Any thoughts about why that could be the case? A little inconsistency there.
Yeah, I've got some thoughts about that. It turns out that there's an enormous number of potentially edible foods that we don't eat. Mm-hmm. And we actually eat only a small fraction of the potential animals that we could eat. And that fraction varies from those specific animals vary from country to country to country. Quite a lot, surprisingly. And those preferences from change. For example, one of the examples I use in my book was that water buffalo were taboo in Nepal for centuries. This anthropologist who studied that people would not eat buffalo, he goes back 10 years later after staying in this village, and they asked him if he'd like some buffalo meat. And they had totally changed their attitudes.
In under 10 years.
In 10 years, they totally changed their attitudes. I never thought that Americans would be gobbling up raw fish at the levels that we did. When I was a kid, if you said Americans are going to eat raw fish, I would have said, no way.
No way. Yeah. Or you even have friends who were vegetarians who are eating raw liver.
Really?
If I'm not mistaken.
I interviewed a woman. It turns out that 2/3 of vegetarians, national studies show, eventually go back to eating meat. And I interviewed a woman who not only went back to eating meat, but she had her boyfriend was the guy who ate roadkill and then had gone from roadkill to eating raw meat. And they both were huge fans of raw meat. And so she ate. I asked her what she had for breakfast that morning. And she said, oh, I had a half a cup of raw liver and a pint of milk.
Yeah. Woo.
That would make me a vegetarian, I'll tell you.
Well, so there's all kinds of inconsistencies here.
I think it's so common. Hal and I both like to say that people are consistently inconsistent about how they think about animals, and I think food is a perfect example of that. And I'm a great example too, and just about everybody I know is too. I was in Africa and offered zebra, and I just couldn't get myself to eat it because it seemed horse-like to me, and I don't want to eat horse. As you all know, horse meat has been a big issue, a big brouhaha, being sort of a surprise protein in Europe. But a lot of people prize it. We were at a friend's not too long ago, and they offered us a choice of, would you like us for dinner tonight to make squirrel? Let's see, it was squirrel, And then a fish that they had caught, venison and rabbit. And a friend of mine said, oh, I couldn't eat rabbits because they're cute. And I don't want to eat squirrel because they just, ooh, I don't know, they seem like rodents. And I was like, ooh, I want to try squirrel. And now I'm watching the squirrels in my backyard and thinking,
There's dinner on foot right there.
So, you know, it's just we're all, I don't know how you know the research better than
my
I do. Well,
the best example of that, I know, sort of the opposite in some ways, and that's vegetarians that eat meat regularly. And there was a Department of Agriculture did a study. Of 3,000 Americans, where they called them up and they asked them about their diet, and 5 or 10% said they were vegetarians, and they called all these people up 2 weeks later, and they asked them what they had had to eat in the previous 24 hours, and almost 70% of the quote vegetarians unquote had eaten animal flesh in the previous 24 hours.
Yeah,
I've had people tell me they're vegetarians while they're eating a tuna fish
chicken
sandwich.
Right. That brings up something that I found really interesting teaching my class at the UW. I teach a class on the biology and philosophy of human-animal relationships. And one of the things I've learned from teaching that class is so many people define meat as red meat.
Yeah.
You know, not muscle, which is sort of biologically what meat is. So not, you know, they think of it not fish. So people will tell me, I'm a vegetarian, I just eat chicken. Which is tremendously ironic if you're interested in welfare, because the life of a commercial chicken is,
compared to a steer,
if you're concerned about welfare issues, then the one animal I would suggest you should not be eating is a commercial chicken.
And yet we're eating way, way, as you point out in your book, way, way, way more chicken than we've ever eaten, and frankly, more chicken than red meat, if I'm not mistaken.
Nine billion a year in the United States.
9 billion chickens.
9 billion chickens a year.
Wow. We have every line full.
That's a lot of McNuggets.
You know, and we should really talk about this inconsistencies. These inconsistencies. I mean, how can we be so inconsistent?
Well, partially it's related to, we have things that enable us to be inconsistent. And one of these is the categories that we put them in. You know, the subtitle of my book is Some We Love, Some We Eat, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. Well, we have animals that we call pets. We have animals that we call pests. And by putting them in those categories. So for example, In the Quran, dogs are considered to be unclean. They're considered vermin. So they're in the pest category, therefore they're not eaten. In the United States, dogs are in the pet category, so we love them, therefore we're not eaten. And so it's the places that eat dogs are places where they're not considered usually loved, or they're not considered pests.
So we can, depending on where you are, you can rationalize.
Yeah, and the problem comes when countries change their minds and cultures change. So, for example, in Korea, where dog breeding has been popular for many years, people are starting to keep dogs as pets more and more. And so this is creating a certain amount of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Even though most Koreans don't eat much dog meat, most Koreans are opposed to banning dog meat, even though pets are becoming more popular. So here we have sort of a cultural clash.
And one of the inconsistencies, one of the parts of Harold's book that I find the most interesting points out an inconsistency within our own country, within one field and within one room, which is we all know how, or many people know that most research on animals is actually done on rodents, on mice and rats.
Yeah.
And some of these animals are quite valuable. You know, they've been genetically bred with certain types of mutations. So when they're a research subject, there are many, many rules, laws, and regulations about how they're to be treated. The Animal Welfare Act allows researchers forces them to do certain things, disallows them from doing other things. They have to be treated with a certain amount of care and concern. Some of those animals, as it turns out, escape from their cages and become rats running around the floor, at which time they change from the category of research subject to pest, where they can be killed with traps or sticky traps, which would never be allowed under the Animal Welfare Act. So that to me is one of the most egregious examples of how we put animals in categories and how that changes how we think of them.
Yeah. And those sticky traps are not very humane. No. Well, they're not humane. Listen, no. Not very. They're not humane at all.
Not a good way to die.
No, not a very. Well, you know, all these people have been anxiously awaiting a time to get on the air here. So I want to give Cheryl and Stevens Point first an opportunity. Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
What's on your mind?
Well, been listening to this program quite interestedly. We have a number of animals as pets, and my husband and I both actively hunt with our dogs. We are bird hunters. And that got me to thinking why or how we handle that difference, because we really do respect the animals that we participate in hunting with our dogs with. And to a large extent, our joy with working with our dogs in partnership is it's kind of like that going back 10,000 years, if you will, and being that predator out in the field. And when you connect and you collect a bird because the dog and you work together, it's in some way celebrating that heritage that we have together in common. And it is absolutely something that the dogs enjoy. I mean, if heaven forbid, if we forget one at home, oh, my Lord, they raise a ruckus.
Comment? Thank you very much for calling. Comment, Hal?
Yeah, a couple of comments. I've hung around with, and I'm from Western North Carolina, and I've hung around with coon hunters and been out with coon hunting. And I understand exactly what you're talking about. The coon hunters that I hung around with took enormous pride in their dogs. Interestingly enough, they treated them differently than they treated the pet dogs that they had. And so, for example, in their case with these coonhounds, the coonhounds would be kept outside, oftentimes kept on chains, which they thought was humane. Other people don't. But they had these almost two categories of dogs. So they had enormous respect for the dogs. But the other interesting thing that I found with hunters is that oftentimes hunters have enormous respect for their prey. And oftentimes they don't get any credit for that. I mean, if you're going to be a good hunter, you've got to really know the animal really well. And I've found that most hunters, you know, the stereotype of the hunters, you know, out there blasting away because they don't like animals. And my sense is that people are out there because they really, really do like animals, including the animals that they're hunting. And that's the kind of inconsistency that I'm so fascinated by. And I think it's part of the human condition.
It's interesting. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Cheryl.
No, it's almost almost like a ritual for us in some ways. I mean, we run pointing dogs, so there's a great deal of extra work that simply goes into getting a dog really proficient in the field and in the retrieve. And for us, you know, emotionally, we kind of justify it as in preservation of game. If you're going to take an animal's life, you should be responsible and make sure you secure that animal and cook it. I mean, we eat everything we take. But it, in some ways, it's an ancient ritual we feel like we're part of.
You know, it's interesting. Yesterday, I was interviewing Richard Crossley, who has a great new book out on his Crossley Guides, ID Guides to Birds. And he was saying he's from England. And in England, there's no hunting, and people don't go out and hunt. And so he said one of the reasons why bird watching is so popular and bird photography is so popular, especially among young men, is because he thinks it's because young men are kind of alike no matter where they are in the world, and it's sort of a hunt, and they're capturing them in life books and with photographs.
Interesting.
Which I thought was a really interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Really interesting take. Thank you so much, Cheryl, for calling. I appreciate it. Matt in Wauwatosa, turn to you. Hi, Matt. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for the wonderful show.
Mm-hmm.
I was just speaking to a friend of mine who's a scientist about animal testing, and she brought up some interesting points. She said many of the people she knows in the sciences turn to biological sciences because they love animals, and they wanted to know more about them, and they wanted to work with them. And that although the testing might seem cruel, it's not done for cruelty's sake. And when labs are destroyed and data is destroyed like was recently, unfortunately that makes the real suffering of these test animals in vain because no data has been collected.
Yeah. Cal, you want to comment on that? And Patricia?
I think Matt's raising two very important points. And the first one is one that's hardly ever talked about, but it can be a serious issue. Probably most scientists that go into animal research do not go into study animals because they really love animals. They're using them as a vehicle for trying to treat a disease or trying to find out some basic biology. But zoologists do that. And both Patricia and I have a background in that. I studied baby snakes for years and years and years, and I was attracted to them because I really liked them. I went into that field because I love these animals. However, you still wind up doing things that you don't like doing. For example, if you're a zoologist that's studying taxonomy, let's say taxonomy of birds, you spend a big chunk of your life in museums surrounded by dead birds that were collected by bird lovers that shot those animals. That's how Audubon.
Yeah.
That's how Darwin. Darwin talks about raising pigeons, and Darwin was conflicted about animal research, and he talks about having to kill one of his pigeons, and he said, "I have done the dastardly deed and killed the little fantail," and he felt. I think there's a form of guilt that comes with that. Much of what we know about the animal mind, the mind of a chimpanzee or the mind of a monkey, comes from studies of captive animals. Mm-hmm. And so to learn about these creatures that we want to spend our life studying involves this conflict between loving them and finding out about them, but sometimes having to do unfortunate things to get at that goal. I think the animal testing issue is a bit of a different issue. Nobody does experiments out of cruelty. Nobody likes to hurt animals. I've never met a scientist that I thought took any joy out of hurting an animal. And I met lots of them that felt a moral burden. There was a moral cost to that, and have given a lot of thought about it. Tricia, you want to come
in? Yeah. You know, there are so many things to talk about, but one of the things that strikes me, talking about how scientists feel about the animals if they're doing research on them, is there's a huge group of people that is almost never talked about, which are the caretakers, the people mm-hmm. who are the animal caretakers in these laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people who are directly responsible for the day-to-day, hour-by-hour health, life, welfare of these particular animals. And most of those people go into it because they do love animals.
That is absolutely true. I've interviewed animal caretakers, and I found that to be the case. In every case, I've asked people, have you ever taken an animal and turned it into a pet? Basically saved it from being an experiment because you fell in love with that dog or that rat, or in one case, a horse. And they said yes. And let me mention that in Guelph, at the university in Guelph, they actually have an annual ceremony to celebrate the animals that have been killed in research there.
Wow.
And one reason they developed that was to help the animal researchers and the animal caretakers, especially the caretakers, the technicians that are working with these animals every day, help deal with their own feelings about this.
And that, I love hearing that. I wish that was more common because I, too, have talked to a lot of animal caretakers. I actually was one once when I was an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. I worked in the primate center. And I was greatly torn. This was a very long time ago. Conditions were very, very different, and I had a really hard time there. And since then, more recently, I've talked to quite a few caretakers, and there is a certain amount of angst and struggle that many of them have, because on the one hand, their job is to keep these animals healthy and happy, and at the same time, the reason they're doing that is so some of these animals are going to be killed, sacrificed, however you want to call it.
Yeah.
And some of them are going to have some kind of a surgery or be given a disease. So they're sort of in this constant tension zone. And I think supporting, but they don't do it if, you know, they believe in what they're doing. They wouldn't do it if they didn't believe in what they're doing. But nonetheless, I think it's a field that needs more support than it actually gets.
I think that's absolutely true. And one of the problems that they have is that Arnie Arluch, one of our colleagues in anthrozoology, talks about being trapped in a gilt cage And the sense that sometimes, you know, if you're at a party and you somebody says, well, what do you do for a living? And you say, well, I'm the animal caretaker at the, you know, in the primate center. That can be a tough one.
Yeah.
It's almost like being an undertaker in some cases. There's certain jobs that are sort of almost taboo in some circumstances. So you've got that lack of social support oftentimes.
Certified applied animal behaviorist Patricia McConnell, one of our guests, the other Hal Herzog, professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. He's an anthrozoologist and author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Lots of callers online. There is one open line, I think, at 1-800-642-1234. You can join in or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Peggy in Eau Claire, thanks a lot for waiting. Hi, appreciate your call.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm not sure if the term has come up yet in your discussion of the concept of speciesism, the idea that the reason why we allow ourselves to treat animals in a certain way is the fact that we objectify them or see them as less important as humans, and the fact that we have also done that with other humans, whether it's slavery, et cetera, that any time we decide that they are less useful or in some way objectified or different, that then we are capable of treating them with less respect and less care. So that we do experimentation on animals that are more intelligent, more aware of their feelings and pain, and that's acceptable, and yet certain humans that are less intelligent or perhaps not as capable, for whatever reason, we would never allow.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling. I want to get some comments from both Harold and Patricia. Hal, you want to start?
Yeah, I think you've raised a very serious issue and one that needs to be taken. They're intellectually troubling. The concept of speciesism was, I think, originally developed by Richard Rider and is the cornerstone of the work of people like Peter Singer and Tom Regan, the animal rights philosopher. And you're absolutely right. Speciesism in some ways is analogous to racism. But the question is, where do you draw that line? So, for example, Joan Dunier, who's an animal rights philosopher, wrote a book called Speciesism. And she concludes, for example, that termites have the right to eat your house, and that if you're in a burning building and there's a puppy and a human infant, you should flip a coin as to which one you should save. And so at some point, there's the sort of theory and there's the reality.
Yeah.
And here, sometimes it just boils down to common sense and moral emotions. You also, I think, raised the most difficult case about animal research, the most troubling argument, the argument that I take most seriously about animal research, which is philosophers called the argument for marginal cases. What do we do about animals that are smarter than some people? And mm-hmm. should we be using people in these experiments rather than animals? Now, I discuss this in my book, actually, and my moral intuition, and it's not logical, it's my moral intuition. My moral intuition really rebels at the idea of doing experiments on severely handicapped children in a way that my moral intuition doesn't rebel against the idea of using, let's say, a monkey, even a smarter monkey. Now, I've got a friend, the philosopher Rob Bass, and we've discussed this, and his moral intuition tells him something completely different. He says that logically and practically, he would rather see experiments done on humans, on severely disabled humans, than he would on intelligent monkeys. So this, you've got to the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
Well, I think the other issue, too, is do we base it on something like intelligence versus the capacity to feel pain and suffering, and therefore can we base our behaviors on understanding that even if they are a different species, that they do not necessarily feel less pain,
less
and therefore
pain.
Should not be objectified. And yes, and I, you know, even in my own life and et cetera, there are a lot of inconsistencies that we all have to challenge ourselves about, because we are simply kind of in a system, a big picture system, that the only way we can survive is to wound and predate, and which is a whole other level of discussion. But thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Patricia, you wanted to maybe respond a little
bit. I absolutely agree with the caller and with Harold that this is sort of the fundamental question. You know, is it ethical to do things to animals because we can? Because we have the power. I mean, really, that's what it gets down to. So, and it's an extremely difficult issue, and it's not just an issue with animal experimentation. There are some animal rights activists who believe that it is exploitative and dominionistic to own pets. I mean, the director of PETA has gone on record of saying in an ideal world there would be no pets, that some people feel that just owning companion animals is exploiting animals for our own purposes. There's a philosopher who I find useful. His name is Van der Veer, and he was originally motivated by a statement that Peter Singer, who wrote Animal Liberation, who talks about speciesism, and is concerned deeply about welfare of animals and is concerned particularly about suffering. And there's a famous line of Singer, I'll paraphrase it. He says, he's not saying that rats and children are equal, but he says they deserve equal consideration. He said we should, because they can both suffer, we should be giving equal consideration to the suffering of rats and the children who they may be biting. This was deeply distressing, morally bothersome to Van der Veer, as I think it is, frankly, to many of us, certainly is to me.
Yeah.
I couldn't possibly put the interests of a rat over that of a child. I couldn't, even though rats are extreme. I mean, they're great. They're intelligent, they're social, you know, they're fascinating animals, highly sentient, highly intelligent, able to feel pain, fear, happiness. What Van der Veer suggests is what he calls two-factor egalitarianism, and basically that's just a phrase to describe a suggestion that we look at two factors at the same time. One is the level of psychological complexity, and the other is the level of interest. You know, are you talking about a life and death kind of interest? Are you talking about a serious interest? Are you talking about a sort of a luxury, you know? And so, therefore, that can help you resolve conflicts. Is it morally ethical, or is it morally sound, for example, to take the life of a rabbit to test mascara for women? And under two-factor egalitarianism, the answer would be like, no, of course not. It gets a lot trickier when you're talking about a more psychologically complex animal like a higher primate and a serious human disease. But at least it gives you a framework to try and sort of wade through some of these really difficult issues.
Yeah, and Hal, in your book, you talk about just what I think Patricia brought up. A rabbit, I'll just use that as an example. I think a rabbit used for mascara would not be seen in the same light as a rabbit used to cure cancer.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that we've seen is that attitudes have changed about that. And there's been a lot of attitude surveys over the years. And one of the things that affects people's views is what is the type of animal? Is it a monkey versus a rat, a cat versus a rat or a mouse, and is it for mascara, or is it for
cancer or whatever
for cancer? There's another issue that's sort of a subtext here that I've been thinking about a lot, and that is, let's say Peggy would eliminate all animal research. and I don't know if she would or not, but let's just say that she, yeah, she would for a second. And let's say I have a sick kid, but I'm convinced that animal research is the only way that we're going to find a treatment for our, for my kid that has, let's say, cystic fibrosis,
mm-hmm,
a really lousy disease.
Yeah.
And at what point does her concern for animals and her wanting to stop research affect my feeling that my child might actually benefit? So that's sort of another level. You know, one of the things we're going to be, that's happened here at in Madison is that there's been a conflict over between very well-meaning people on both sides of this debate over the utility and ethics of this whole research. So there's a whole lot of levels of complexity here.
Talking about these complex relationships between humans and animals with Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist and professor of psychology, Hal Herzog, who has written Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking with Patricia McConnell and Hal Herzog. Patricia, certified applied animal behaviorist, Hal Herzog, author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Go to my Facebook page. I have links to both of their sites. And I hope you take a look. There's some interesting things. And Hal, you've got a blog going as well.
Yeah, I do. It's on Psychology Today. It's called Animals and Us. So if you Google Hal Herzog, Animals and Us, it'll pop up and I talk about all kinds of interesting things. Gives me a lot of flexibility for talking about all kind of animal stuff.
And Patricia has the same. Hey, you have a great blog, too.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Hal's blog is my favorite blog, I will just say. It's just fascinating. Very, very well done. Very thoughtful.
Yeah, well, it's there are fun places to go. Scott in Dodgeville, thanks for waiting. Hello.
I think you guys put way too much thought into this.
I agree.
Well, no, but I think there's animals here for research. There's animals here for transportation. There's animals here to eat. I just think that they're here for a reason and that we have to embrace a reason, and that's just my opinion.
But what do you think about the I appreciate that question. I think it's a great question. What do you think about the fact that the reason varies depending on what year it is and what country it is and is so influenced by sort of how you grew up and your cultural mores? I mean, there are places in Africa that think that maggots are like the best food in the world, you know? Maybe
not. Here's what you have to look at. We're all different. We all have different cultures. And I believe that you have to work within your culture, because you're absolutely right. What you were raised with is what you know. And I do laugh. I mean, I think this is a great topic today. I love vegetarians that eat fish. I just picked up my favorite animals today. I just got some brisket, some pulled pork, and some sausage. I have no problems eating barbecue. I don't think I would eat a horse, and I don't think I would eat a dog or a cat. But if you're hungry enough, I'm sure you could do it.
Hal, go ahead and comment.
Yeah, let me tell you why I spend my time doing this stuff. Why I spend my time thinking too much. My book, at one level, my book is about human-animal interactions. However, I was being interviewed by Frank Stacio, another public radio interviewer, and I walked in the radio station. He says, Dr. Herzog, I just read your book. It's not really about animals, is it? And I said, oh, exactly. Finally, you'd really get it. It's not about animals. It's about what it means to be a human in a complicated world. And so my interest is, because I'm a psychologist, is I see that these issues draw out the best and the worst in human nature. It brings out people's passion, sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a bad way. It deals with dealing with really tough ethical issues. And I'm sure you've got some tough ethical issues. You say that you chow down on all this stuff, and I do too, by the way. But I think there's probably some animal ethical issues that probably send you up the wall. And the question is, what does this reflect about human nature? And just to say, well, it's culture and it's the way you're raised. To me, it's not that simple. It's a little more complicated. And to me, that's what makes this an interesting area of study.
Yeah.
But I agree. We think too much. That's the problem with academics. I've always thought that.
Thanks.
I didn't mean it derogatory.
I know, but you're right.
But I think that people, I mean, look, there's a fine line between research and abuse. Okay? I don't think anybody should be abused. I don't think any animals should be abused. But I think if the animal, like a rat or a rodent, I mean, look at rabbits. All those creatures can multiply tons and tons of times. I think that's a research animal. And I know it's hard for some people because there are people that have pet rats or pet mice. I mean, I've eaten alligator and rattlesnake. And to me, it's just, I think we all have to find what's acceptable within each other.
Yeah.
That's my thought on that.
No, and I think I want to support that statement that we all have to find what's acceptable, and that's part of why I do what I do, too, because... And my views have changed over the years about what I find my own behavior, what is acceptable and what is not. And I learn more and sort of learn more about myself and learn more biology and learn more about the world and how animals are treated and cared for and wildlife conservation problems. I change. So I think you're right. It's a very personal issue. My hope is that everybody makes those decisions based on a lot of knowledge about the reality of sort of mm-hmm. what's going on in the world and on some kind of thoughtful philosophy. You know, I tell my students when we get to the philosophy section, I say, everybody has a philosophy. You may not know what it is, but something drives you. Something causes you to make decisions. And I'm just one of those sort of reflective people that like to overthink things and like to think about things and think about why we do what we do.
Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Enjoy your lunch.
Yeah,
enjoy. Making me hungry.
Enjoy your lunch. Thanks a lot for calling. Mayor in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Well, you all are overwhelming me a bit, but this is a great show, and I appreciate the last caller. And Patricia, I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
I love the book, Dr. Hirschhog. I'm going to get it and read it. And just a brief comment, because you have brought up so many great issues. I'm a farm kid that did 4-H projects and a horse trainer, dog trainer, cat, everything you can imagine. And my cow was the smartest animal I had.
Wow.
Now, my cow, because I won the blue ribbon, was slaughtered and cut up and sold at Piggly Wiggly. So me winning the 4-H and having the best cow meant that my cow was killed. So then, in fact, I became a vegetarian. So I don't know if people understand that. I think there's a big disconnect about where meat comes from.
Yeah.
Where does it come from? You look in the eyes of these animals every day, and you become so attached, and you train them, and you do everything for them, and they're so smart. And somebody told me once that cows are so smart because there's so many generations of them raised in our presence, in human presence, that they become very in tune to us, much like a dog or a cat or a bird and a domesticated animal. So they are so smart, and we're breeding such quick generations of them. What do you think about?
Yeah.
Well, I think, well, your story about your cow winning, that's amazing. And have you stuck with your vegetarianism after that?
Oh, absolutely.
So that was a fundamental turning point in your life. And those are the sorts of things that I'm absolutely interested in. That's amazing to me. I mean, I think this is sort of not my area, but I've talked with people about 4-H, and I had the feeling that's one of the purposes of 4-H, one of the parts of 4-H is the socialization of raising animals and yet knowing that they're eventually going to be slaughtered. That's part of the deal. And in your case, it worked the other way. Your point about us getting away from the knowledge of where meat comes from is really a big one. And basically the meat industry has helped us with that. When I was a kid, if we were going to have chicken, my mother went out and bought a chicken carcass, and it, you know, looked like a carcass. You had to cut it up; it had bones and stuff like that in it. Nowadays, fewer than 10% are sold in stores as carcasses, and the rest of it's sort of dismembered things that you, pieces of flesh that you sell in plastic. They look more like a vegetable than they do a piece of flesh. And I think you're absolutely right. I think what's happened is that we sort of demeatified meat to make it easier for people, to buy and eat. And people have lost that touch with that it was a real animal.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We are going to be talking right up until 12:30 today with our two guests, Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist and author of several books, Hal Herzog, professor of psychology at Western Carolina University and author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. And boy, we're getting some great comments and questions from you today. I'm so glad that you're listening in and contributing either by phone or Facebook and emails. And we'll take some more Facebook and email and, of course, more calls as well after we take a look at the news. So please stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Animals and humans, of course, are constantly relating to one another, and humans often hold the fate of animals, different animals, in their hands. And how do we as individuals and as a culture decide which animals are worthy of protection and care versus others that are fine to raise for food or as subjects in medical experiments? Hi, Larry Mueller here. A couple of guests today who can comment on that to help us through this maze of conflicting ideas. Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist. Patricia, always great to have you with us.
Always good to be here.
And Hal Herzog, a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University, anthrozoologist, author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think About Animals, or Think Straight About Animals, I should say. And he's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. There's a forum on animal research ethics. And Hal, thanks for spending time with us today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
We have so many people online and so many callers. Deborah's been waiting an awfully long time, so let's go there. Deborah, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. I just wanted to call in to stress that there is reciprocity in this whole system of medical research using animals to benefit humans, but also a lot of human experimentation has benefited animals. My examples are, I've been a nurse for 40-some-odd years, worked at a university hospital. I watched the very early days of kidney transplant, liver transplant, bone marrow transplant, stem cell transplant, watched what my patients went through, and they suffered. The learning curve was ferocious. It has worked really well. I now have a friend who's a veterinarian in Chicago who does stem cell transplants on pets to alleviate I believe it's mostly degradation of joints, and it's getting great success. And it's very slick and quick and painless, and it works well. And they learn that on people. And the other thing is we have a dog who spends a lot of time at the vet school, initially for Cushing's, and we had to get special compensation, compassionate care allowance to allow us to use trilestane to treat him, which wasn't allowed in this country. We use it on people. That's how we learned about the drug. And he has had a phenomenal recovery from that. Now we're treating him for cancer with medications that I've seen, that I've used with my patients over the years. But it goes both ways, is what I'm saying. I am grateful to the people who suffered that now, because of that, my dog is thriving.
Yeah.
And I was grateful to the animals that taught us things so that my patients would survive.
Oh, that really interesting. Hal, a comment?
Well, it's such a great point. It's something that's really rarely brought up. I mean, we're seeing more and more treatments for things like, you know, it used to be, you know, if your dog got cancer or had, you know, hip problems or joint problems and things like that, that they would euthanize it. Now there's, you know, high-tech medical treatments that are available in veterinary medicine. You're exactly right. And it's just such a great point. And I also just like to point along the same lines is that animal research also benefits animals, and that's something that's sometimes left out of the equation as well. But you're making a terrific point. Thanks so much for saying that.
Really appreciate that. We got a comment from Valerie and Boaz. who suffers from inconsistency. She says, for years I was mostly vegan and would not wear leather. But since I've gotten horses, including rescues, I'm guilty of using leather products that are part of saddles. I love animals, but it's so difficult to completely avoid animal products.
Valerie is up against what I call the animal activist paradox. And that is that the greater your moral clarity, the harder it is for you to get through the day sometimes. And I remember I was giving a talk, and a woman came up to me after the talk. She's a professor at University of Washington, actually. And she said, you know, I'm a vegan, but I feel so conflicted about wearing these shoes that I just love. And then she pointed to these shoes, and she had these really cute little red leather shoes, and she was just really conflicted about it. And I've met animal activists who, for example, gave up some real pleasures in their life. They gave up playing baseball. They gave up playing softball because they couldn't find balls or gloves that they could substitute. I've met folks that wouldn't kill the fleas and ticks on their dog. And so what they would do is that they would try and pick them off one by one. I've met activists who felt guilty driving down the road because they knew that they were killing bugs. So to get through your life requires, I think, some compromises sometimes, because you only have one life and you want it to be fulfilling and not just completely narrowly focused. And so I think this can be a problem, and I think I have enormous respect for animal activists. I have enormous respect for their moral vision, but I know some that have become almost paralyzed in a sense because of the clarity of that moral vision. Mm. And I think you need to make peace with where you can make compromises.
I want to mention again and bring up that you're speaking tonight at it's the Forum on Animal Research Ethics on the UW-Madison campus. It's at the biochemistry building, 440 Henry Mall, which was a building that I used to work out of a long time, for many years, actually. It's a beautiful building with lots of parking nearby. And you're speaking at 7 o'clock tonight. And I assume some of these same kinds of issues, Hal, you're going to be...
Yeah, what I'm going to be... I'm glad you asked. What I'm going to be doing is giving a general overview, really primarily in some ways for non-specialists. You know, it's not designed for members of animal research committees and things like that. It's mm-hmm. basically more for the general public or people that have an interest in animal issues. And it's going to be a general overview of the animal research issue. And I'm not going to provide easy answers for difficult questions. Yeah. And I'll just say that right now. But I am going to raise difficult questions and give my perspective on why they're so hard and why this debate is so acrimonious sometimes.
Yeah, Patricia, you.
Yeah, speaking of difficult questions, going back to what you were talking about earlier, the caller who called in was a vegan yet was using leather. This is, you know, this whole question of sort of how do you get through the day and feel comfortable with the decisions that you're making, which can get very complicated and very difficult, as Hal was saying, if you have the kind of moral clarity in which you are not wanting to use any animal products. One of the things that's helped me that I think helps a lot of people, and I talk about it in my class at the university, is to mm-hmm. widen the perspective, is to look at, rather than just looking at our species, look at life on Earth. And it turns out there are many, many kinds of relationships between different species. There are predatory relationships, there are parasitic relationships, and there are a lot of symbiotic relationships, some of which are called mutualistic, in which both species benefit from their association. And there are lots and lots and lots of them. You know, there are lots and lots of species. There are oxpeckers who live on the backs of ungulates, hoofed animals mm-hmm. in Africa, and eat the ticks and the external parasites. There are cleaner fish that actually have cleaning stations where large fish like a grouper will come up to an area, sort of set, agreed upon, as it will, area under the water somewhere. And the grouper will open its mouth, and these little tiny cleaner fish will come in and clean the teeth and the, mm-hmm. the oral cavity of these particular animals. There are birds who do that to tortoises, for example. So they're lots and lots of examples of symbiotic relationships, and there are often a lot of examples of costs and benefits. And so it helped me, anyway, to sort of look at the big picture and to think of us as one species on Earth, granted a very complicated and weird one in many, many ways, mm-hmm. with granted a tremendous amount of power, but thinking about the fact that it is sort of normal and natural to have relationships between animals, and that we are, even though we're so different, we're still part of the web of the earth. And I think because we are different, we have moral responsibilities to not cause unnecessary suffering. But I think it's part of the web of life that animals are intricately associated with each other. And I don't think it's even right to try and separate ourselves from all other animals in all ways. That's just my perspective.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I'm wondering here. Let's go to Ruth in Madison. Ruth, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. And hi, Trish. This is Ruth from the Bird Club. But anyway, I wanted to add to the symbiotic situation here a question that when we take on pets and things that we actually extend the lives of these animals. And if these animals were left as PETA would have it in the wild, that over 90% of them probably would not see their first birthday. And yet when we keep them as pets, then they get to live. And granted, it's not in the wild state, and one could say that. But they also rarely want for food. They don't want for water. You know, Mother Nature does not necessarily provide the hawk-free watering place, or doesn't necessarily keep those seeds from being covered up with snow so that this animal can live. You know, whereas we as pet owners would make sure that our animals got food and water every day.
Mm. Patricia, comment?
Well, I think your point is very well taken, and it's an important one. I know that some activists, not all, but some activists, for example, Tom Reagan was here a couple of years ago and gave a speech about animal rights. And I actually asked him, as a member of the audience, I asked him, how do you feel about companion animals and pets? And he said, I see them as you would displaced victims of war. I'm sort of paraphrasing. He said, unable to live well in the wild anymore, but unable to truly be happy in the sort of captive situation. So his argument, and that of some, is that basically we should spay and neuter all companion animals and basically let them go extinct. That would be the kindest thing. There are other arguments that basically, Alec Rawls, for example, who basically said being a vegetarian is sort of like genocide in that you're talking about the extinction of vast, vast numbers of animals. Most of us are in the middle somewhere, but I can tell you there are many perspectives about that very issue.
Ruth, again, thank you so much. Anna in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Sure. I'm calling because this is such a fascinating topic, and I've been watching my 4-year-old struggle with it because last summer we established an egg-laying flock of chickens in our backyard, and I also roast chickens quite regularly. And we've always been very open about where meat comes from. The first time I pulled one out of the oven, he said, is that one of our chickens? I said, no, it wasn't. And he said, well, good. And then the second time I roasted a chicken, he said, you know, Mom, he said, I don't want to eat chickens anymore. It makes me feel bad, and I don't think they should be killed for food. And it's just been interesting watching the evolution and him struggle with the ethics himself at such a young age.
Oh, yeah. Hal, comment?
Well, a really interesting observation. I've got twin daughters, and one of my twin daughters decided when she was about 8 that she was going to become a vegetarian. And we said, okay, sure. We figured that would last, I don't know, a couple weeks, a couple months. Well, that was 22 years ago. And she still is. She still is, yeah. It's interesting that some people are like that. Some kids are like that, and it's great.
Yeah. Laura from Milwaukee emailed in and said, I made the decision to become a vegan a few years ago. The confusion of eating a steak while petting my dog was too much for me.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's there's no way around it. I mean, there's just a lot of conflict and tension. A lot of people know I have sheep and I raise lambs. I've been really busy trying to keep 17 little lambs healthy, and a couple of them were compromised. And I actually had lunch with a colleague not too long ago, and I said, I have to go. I have to lecture. And then as soon as I'm done lecturing, I have to get home because I'm worried about these triplets of spots. All of my ewes, by the way, have names, would never be sent, shipped away. And yet one of their lambs will end up in my freezer. And so my colleague said, as we were leaving, she said, you know, I have such sympathy for your concerns about your lambs, and you're obviously so worried about them and so want them to do well. She said, but they're going to die in a couple of months anyway. How do those two things go together? And it's a very, very good question. I mean, I've thought about it for a long time.
Well, the interesting thing is that most people don't think about it. And in a sense, that's why I wrote my book. It's like, this raises a question of cognitive dissonance, and which is one of the fundamental ideas in psychology. Very powerful idea that when you have two conflicting ideas, it makes you anxious and something has to give. Well, I don't believe in that anymore because most people have no problem at all petting their dog at the same time they're eating a steak. So you're in a fairly small minority of people that actually have thought about these issues deeply and have changed your life because of it. Well over 95% of Americans eat animals.
Yeah. And I thank you, Patty. I'm sorry, it wasn't Patty. Patty had a different question here, but wondering what you thought about dog fights and why cats and dogs are given preferential treatment in the U.S. in comparison to other animals like farm animals.
Well, there's a lot we could talk about there. The thing I wanted to jump in about is how, again, inconsistent we can be. For example, there's an issue here in Wisconsin right now, related, I would argue, to dog fights, in that dog fighting is illegal. It's very much frowned upon, although culturally not that long ago, that was not true. But as I think a lot of people know, there was a law passed not that long ago that it is legal to use dogs to hunt wolves in the wolf hunt. And there's absolutely no question that, at least in some circumstances, that's going to result in violent encounters between wolves and dogs, mm-hmm. which you could basically call state-sponsored dogfighting. And I see a tremendous problem, I think, as a violation of the animal cruelty laws in Wisconsin, but some people don't. Some people argue that they should be able to send their hounds after wolves. There are bear hounds right now who sometimes get into it with bears and are injured or killed. The bears sometimes are injured. So there is a tremendous tension between what we culturally say is wrong, dog fighting, but also do talk about categories and inconsistencies. It's just another example of that.
Yeah. Gary and Boz Cabell, hello, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Larry. I was at an Earth Day celebration the other day in the Kickapoo Valley, and the celebration was about the human community there and interacting with the valley, protecting the valley, and being opposed to frack sand mining and high-capacity wells and things like that. And after I left that meeting, I got to thinking about it, and the human community has always been about the human community, And we have never learned, and hopefully someday we will, but we have never learned how to interact with plant communities and with insect communities and with bird communities and with tree communities and with wetland communities. We don't know how to communicate with them. We can communicate with each other and tell each other what we want, and most of the time it's for our own selfish needs. And we really don't understand how to read the forest or bird activity or bird species. And when they disappear, we don't ask ourselves if that's been a way of that community of telling us that what we're doing is not compatible with what they need. And until we learn how to communicate with other communities and open our eyes and learn the message, be able to pick up on the messages that they're sending us about what we're doing to their communities in a negative way, we're always going to be in a position of being dominant of nature and basically grinding it under our feet, maybe inadvertently, but still damaging it.
Hmm.
I think that's an interesting idea in terms of community level thinking. There have been a couple of papers written about the cost to animal life of people that are vegetarians and vegans. That we don't normally think about the insects that are destroyed, the small mammals that are destroyed by large scale, growth of things like soybeans and things like that. There is and if you're thinking community level, that's part of our big, big footprint that's doing a lot of squashing things.
Good points. Thank you very much. Dick in Presque Isle. Hello. Thanks for waiting.
It's Rick. Just a very quick observation of perspective. A friend of mine was commenting one time that, in her opinion, pigs were smarter than dogs. And my observation was, if the pig is smarter than the dog, then why ain't the dog the pig laying by the fireplace?
Good one, Dick. Good one.
I think if pigs had the opportunity, I think they would have taken over the fireplace, actually. There actually is some some research by some cognitive scientists that does indeed suggest that in terms of certain measures like problem solving, I don't want to get them competitive with each other, but certainly one, pigs are extremely intelligent. They're highly social. They're quite smart. I've seen some rankings that actually did put pigs over dogs. I just will never tell my border collie that.
Well, I want to remind everybody that tonight, this has been such an interesting conversation. Tonight, you have a chance to actually continue that conversation. Because Hal Herzog is going to be giving a talk at UW-Madison. It's a forum on animal research ethics. And it's at 7 o'clock tonight at the Biochemistry Building on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. It's on Henry Mall. There are parking lots 17, 20, 36, 40, and 41. All of those lots, you can park your car there. It's free. And you're going to have a chance to, and Patricia, you're going to be there. You'll be there as well. And a chance to hear what Hal's got to say. And also to ask your own question. I'm sure you're going to have a chance for people to ask questions.
Sure.
Absolutely. Well, in the meantime, thank you both very much. It's been a very enjoyable 90 minutes. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
It was great. You got very intelligent listeners. Really impressed with their questions.
Really good ones. We have great listeners. Hal Herzog, professor of psychology at Western Carolina University, author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. And, of course, Patricia McConnell, certified applied animal behaviorist. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You'll find links to their blogs and their sites. You're certainly going to want to tune in. And thank you for listening. And stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.